all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800.
We're glad to have Marco Masick on Veterans Radio today to talk about his new book, The Storm on Our Shores, a great story about World War II and probably a bit of history that very few Americans still know about. Mark, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Well, this is a great story and written really well. It's very readable. I guess I'd expect that from a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and best-selling author who graduated from Northwestern University and spent a bunch of time in the news industry, in particular the Denver Post. But I had to read all the way to the end of the book to find out that your father was a Marine.
Or is a Marine. I don't think there's any such thing as an ex-Marine, is there?
There you go.
You bet. My dad served during peacetime, between wars, between Korea and Vietnam, but it shaped his life and led some big lessons for me as well.
Well, and whether he knew it or not, he was imparting a certain approach to life to you. So this story, you're not our typical military writer that we hear about on Veterans Radio. Mark, tell us how you came about to write The Storm on Our Shores.
Well, my first nonfiction book was about competitive bird watching, of all things. How many species of birds can you find in 1 year in North America? They actually made a movie out of my book, starring Jack Black and Steve Martin and Owen Wilson. It turns out that one of the best places to find rare birds in North America through the 1980s and 1990s was this place called Attu Island, the westernmost island of the Aleutian chain. So far out there, they actually curve the international dateline around it to keep North America all on the same calendar page. It's farther west than Fiji. It's about the same. It's about as far out there as New Zealand, actually. And so when I researched the history of the island, I just started finding things that really startled me. That, number one, the Japanese had invaded and conquered part of Alaska during World War II. I didn't know that. That it was the first U.S. soil lost since the War of 1812. Didn't know that either. Or that this was the only ground battle of World War II fought in North America. I didn't know that. And also didn't know that the casualty rate at the Battle of Attu was exceeded in the Pacific War only at Iwo Jima. So although it was kind of a forgotten battle, there was a lot that was really pretty noteworthy to me. But ultimately, you're right. I'm not your typical military writer. I thought the war history parts were really interesting, but ultimately what really hooked me on this story was the people involved, the soldiers themselves.
Well, it's a very interesting story. You're right. I think if you asked 100 Americans, did the Japanese ever occupy U.S. soil during the World War II, you know, 99% of them are going to say no, because they've never really been taught or heard about this effort in June of 1942, where the Japanese landed on Attu and Kiska and the Aleutian chain. And Attu is just this good-for-nothing rock in the middle of the Bering Sea. At the time, tell us a little bit about what was on the island in terms of population and industry or what have you.
Well, there was no industry. There was a grand total of about four dozen native Aleuts living on Attu, and they were it was a subsistence living. They would take kayaks out and long spears and hope to get a whale every year to get them through the winter. They would harvest salmon that were running up the creeks. Also, there was an outsider school teacher and her husband, but you know, there was no military threat whatsoever from Attu. The Japanese could have taken that island with a bullhorn. And the only reason to take this island, you know, invading Attu really only makes sense, I think, if you're sitting in an office in Tokyo or, you know, who knows, maybe even Washington. Because if you look at a map, you could see that, you know, this is a good midpoint, might make a good forward base if you ever wanted to, from Japan, launch an attack on the west coast of the United States. Attu also, the Japanese had hoped to use it as a feint to divert U.S. attention from the real action, which was at, of course, the Battle of Midway. It didn't work. You know, the U.S. had cracked the codes. They knew that Midway was coming. They didn't divert substantial numbers of troops to Attu. And instead, Japan ended up sending a garrison of about 3,000 men to an island that has some of the worst weather on Earth. whatever a general in Tokyo thought that Attu might make strategic sense, that idea was obliterated once you're on the ground in Attu. It is a miserable place in general. There's only 8 days a year that are free of snow or rain or sleet or fog. Soldiers in this battle talked about how they often couldn't see the front of their rifles because the fog was so dense. No real way to build or operate an air base there. Just the weather was horrific.
Well, and as you say, this was sort of one of these great mistakes made by some military planners in Japan, and then equally large mistakes made by military planners in Washington, D.C., thinking that this rock had some strategic value, which it did not. But nonetheless, the number of troops who fought and died on Attu is astounding. Before we get into the micro discussion of the two main characters of the book, give us that macro look about this battle to retake Attu.
Sure. Well, you know, for starters, Attu, it's a rock. It's volcanic. 3,000-foot mountains. About 95% of the island is surrounded by cliffs. But the thing is, it's actually pretty big. It's 350 square miles, you know, about 15 times bigger than Manhattan. And so there's a lot of space to do something on Attu, if only you could see, because Attu is at the confluence of the really cold Bering Sea and the warmer currents from the Pacific Ocean. It just has it's socked in with fog all the time. But then it has this crazy weather phenomenon called Willawas, which are, because of the mix of the hot and the warmer and the cold currents, you get these spontaneous hurricane force winds that just come rocketing down from these ice encrusted volcanoes, 3,000-foot mountains, and they'll knock you on your butt. You know, these 80 mile an hour winds, and there's no warning. I was out on Attu in September, and I can vouch that willawas are frightening during peacetime. I can't imagine trying to prosecute a war with somebody shooting at you during, while willawas are knocking you over. It's a crazy place.
So the Japanese take Attu with really no resistance at all. They just show up and the villagers sort of say, "What are you guys doing here?" But central to this book, The Storm on Our Shores, are two men, one a Japanese doctor and one a American Army soldier, and it's really their interaction that makes this book so intriguing. So let's start with, tell us about the Japanese doctor?
Sure. He's the one who really kind of hooked me into the story in the first place. I mean, as a writer, to get the chance to tell a battle from both sides was really pretty fascinating to me. And so the first man, his name is Nobuo Tatsuguchi, born and raised in Hiroshima, but a devout Christian, a Seventh-day Adventist. And he, for college, moves from his native Japan to attend school at Pacific Union College in the Napa Valley of California. It's a Seventh-day Adventist school. And then goes to medical school at Loma Linda University, also in Southern California, and interns as a surgeon at White Memorial Hospital in Los Angeles. Nobuo Tatsuguchi, actually, once he moves to the United States, changes his name to Paul Tatsuguchi. He loves America. He loves the freedom and the open spaces and the long roads. And I think the emphasis in the United States on pushing to succeed rather than trying to avoid embarrassment and shame. He just found the U.S. really invigorating. Plus, he really liked the ice cream here, too. And so he loved the U.S. so much that his girlfriend comes over from Japan. He proposes to her at Yosemite National Park. They get married in Los Angeles and then set off on a honeymoon trip on one of the first Greyhound bus tours from Los Angeles all the way to Niagara Falls in New York. I mean, what more American thing can you do but in that era, honeymoon in Niagara Falls?
Absolutely. It's a true romance story between the two of them and their adoption of the American way of life. And you can just see how this story is supposed to roll out if the world doesn't get in the way. But the world does get in the way, and Paul and his wife have to return to Japan right about the time that the war is beginning to break out, after they've seen the whole country and seen the sort of size and might of the United States. So Paul finds himself, I think, conscripted into the Japanese army. Is that right?
He does. Conscripted against his will. As a devout Seventh-day Adventist, he is morally opposed to war. He's a pacifist. You know, I think that if he were an American, he likely would have filed for a conscientious objector status. Of course, Japan doesn't have anything like that. And so, you know, he has the great misfortune to be back in Japan after Pearl Harbor, and then is, as you mentioned, conscripted to fight for Japan against the nation he loves, the United States. And so he is really torn. He loves his homeland, but he really, really loves the United States. His faith says that he is a pacifist. He can't wage war, but he is conscripted to fight for the Imperial Army. And ultimately, on that second point, Tatsuguchi kind of settles his conscience by saying that he is not actually going to be waging war. He is going to be healing by his work as a surgeon. And so the problem, well, he has many issues, but one big one is that his neighbors, his countrymen, don't trust him anymore because he has spent so much time in the United States and become Americanized. There's a lot of suspicion that Paul Tatsuguchi is a spy. Best I can tell, he is the only surgeon in the Imperial Army who is not given officer status. And so they don't really trust him, but they really need the manpower. And so they ship him off to this place that nobody's ever heard of, this westernmost point of Alaska called Attu. And when he's shipped out, his wife is pregnant, and Tatsuguchi, you know, like many soldiers before and many soldiers since, starts wondering, why am I in this place that I've never heard of? Why am I being asked to help a war that not only is he morally opposed to, but pragmatically, as you mentioned, I mean, he has traveled across the United States and he has seen the industrial and economic might of this big country and all the natural resources available to the United States to use during a war. And so pragmatically, he also knows that there's no way that Japan can ever come out on top in a protracted war with the United States. And yet here he is fighting in Alaska against the United States.
You tell in the book about the struggles of his wife, and she has they have two daughters. One is Laura, one is Joy. That's important, and we'll come back to those daughters at the end here. But let's turn to the American soldier, Dick Laird, who I think's got to be the most unluckiest Army guy in World War II, because he found a way to fight in every god-awful battle in the Pacific. The first...
Oh, it is staggering what he went through.
He's a
boy. But Laird, I mean, Laird, even to start, I mean, even before the Army, I mean, how, the way that he got there, I mean, he's born and raised really, really poor in Appalachia. You know, I think he'd lived in something like 10 different coal towns before the time he was even 12 years old. Families just traveling around trying to scrounge by on any work they can get. And at age 14, Laird is forced to drop out of school to support his family, which he does by, at age 14, becoming an underground coal miner. At age 16, he is actually an underground coal mining explosives expert, detonating charges, you know, way below the surface in Ohio. And, you know, he's getting hurt. His friends are getting hurt, maimed, killed all around him. You know, it's a really, really dangerous job, underground coal mine in Appalachia during this time. And so Laird actually signs up for the Army because he thinks that the Army is safer than sticking it out as a coal miner in the East Coast of the United States. And so he ends up signing on to the Army, lying about his age to get in so he can sign up earlier, and ends up training with his division in the Mojave Desert of California, because all the word is that they are training in the desert so they can take on Rommel and the Nazis in the desert sands of North Africa.
Well, that's
and then
perfect.
They get word.
Yeah, perfect,
and
perfect training to be sent north to Alaska Tattoo, where it's colder than you can imagine, and all that training was for naught. I want to mention that he also, after Tattoo, which is his bloody battle, he goes to Laid Gulf, and he goes to Okinawa. Bloody battles.
Don't forget Kwajalein. He was there, too.
That's right. And he's highly decorated. But as our listeners would know, and Mark, we're talking to Mark Omaske, who's the author of The Storm on Our Shores. Mark, our listeners would understand that he also then, from all these experiences, is suffering what we would call today PTSD. That wouldn't have been the term back in World War II. And I'm speeding this up a little bit because I want to get to the diary and ultimately the burden that Dick Laird carries throughout the rest of his life for engaging in mortal combat with Paul, and maybe the healing that occurs with Paul's daughter. So tell us a little bit about the diary.
Sure. While Paul Tatsuguchi is in this garrison of 3,000 Japanese men on Attu, he starts writing a war diary, which is the one surviving account of what it is like to be on the receiving end of the most ferocious fighting force in the history of the earth. The Japanese are getting bombarded for days, for weeks, by U.S. soldiers. And Tatsuguchi writes about how he is holed up in a cave as a surgeon, and he is performing amputations while he's being shelled. He's suturing patients while shrapnel is flying. They are running out of food. They're running out of ammunition. They're running out of hope. And so finally, this force of 3,000 Japanese men, they've been totally abandoned by their government. government doesn't even, the Japanese government doesn't even try to rescue them. 3,000 men, and they've been decimated down to a surviving force of about 500. The commander organizes them and sets them off on what turns out to be one of the biggest bonsai attacks of the war. They desperately need to come up with some food and ammunition. And so Dick Laird looks above him on a knoll and sees that a squad of about 8 Japanese soldiers has captured an American mortar. And they are turning that mortar back around so that it points not at the front lines anymore, but turns back on the American forces themselves. And Laird realizes that this could be an awful turning point of a battle. And so he pulls out a grenade, throws it, goes up, surveys the damage, realizes not all are killed. He finishes that and then scrambles looking anywhere for any kind of intelligence that might indicate what the Japanese are really up to. Laird finds two things. One, he finds an address book that is full of names written in English and addresses in California. This is Paul Tatsuguchi's address book and contains the names and addresses of his former medical school classmates in California. Laird also then finds a sheet of writings written in Japanese. He files it away, continues fighting, and gets those Japanese pages to the back lines to be translated. They come back. Laird really hopes that this document that he has found on the battlefield, he really hopes that this contains some insight into or military plans into what the Japanese are up to. And instead, it becomes almost a more powerful document because what it finds or what it shows is not military strategy, but it shows that the man he killed loved his wife and really missed his two daughters and had no interest in fighting in Alaska himself. And Laird and the American soldiers had been told all through their training that, you know, the Japanese were heartless, ruthless killers. They hadn't expected to find that the Japanese also contained fathers like themselves. And so this diary goes on the World War II version of going viral. It's passed from fighting man to fighting man, U.S. serviceman. And really, I think in many ways changes the way that a number of soldiers started to view the enemy. And as you know, in war, it's easy to kill an enemy, but it's harder to kill a man. And Laird ends up suffering nightmares. The first night, the second night, for weeks. I mean, as you mentioned, he hit many of the bloodiest places in the Pacific campaign. But he just can't shake this feeling that he killed the wrong guy in Alaska. In fact, Laird won the Silver Star, you know, the Army's third highest honor for killing Tatsuguchi and that other squad that was trying to capture the American mortar. And so he is just racked by this. And even years later, after the war, his life in many ways is still kind of defined by those days in Attu and the one incident. You know, Laird had to drop out of school at age 14. And here he's killed a guy who had achieved the pinnacle of academic success. He's a really accomplished surgeon. And so finally, Laird just can't take it anymore. And wants to settle his conscience. And he just shows up one day at the home of a woman in Los Angeles and knocks on the door. And he's obviously really nervous and he starts babbling. I don't think he really thought through what he wanted to do until he gets back to the car and realizes his time is up. And he turns over his shoulder and says to the woman, "Oh, by the way, I'm the one who killed your father." And indeed he was. He had gone to meet the daughter of the man he killed in war.
He went to see Laura Tatsuguchi Davis, who was now living in California with her mother. This is many years, decades later. The story that you write, though, is rich in information about the struggles of the family after the war, after their breadwinner was lost, the struggles of coming to a new country, the wife, Tycho, was enamored with but had to leave and now come back to. I mean, you've really, Mark, done a great job of telling this military history from the viewpoint of two soldiers, different armies, different stations in life, and two families, and the ripple effect through all of that. I don't know how you knew that's where you were going to end up, but it's a very interesting story and very readable, which is, I think, a demonstration of all your years of writing for the printed press, that the storm on our shores is so readable. It's a commendable job.
Well, thanks. I didn't know where the story would go. I just kind of chased the thread. And in the end, I kind of concluded that, you know, it's the politicians who declare war, and it's the generals who wage war, but ultimately it's people who fight the wars. And it's especially people who live with the consequences of war. And, you know, some are able to figure it out in different ways than others. But here is a story that just moved me so much, because ultimately the family of Paul Tatsuguchi got together with Dick Laird, the man who had killed their father. And Tatsuguchi's family realizes, the Japanese soldiers realize, that Dick Laird, the American serviceman, the American war hero, is just carrying this really big burden. And so Tatsuguchi's daughter sits, well, first she goes out to lunch with him, which is awkward, but still civil. And she gets home and realizes that burden, that Laird is really burdened. And so she writes him really one of the most moving letters I've ever seen. And what she does is forgives him. And I just think that we live in such divided times now. You know, our society is split. And yet here's a case where these are two families who were at war. They were enemies. One family killed the other, and they could figure it out.
They had real reason to hate, and they learned not to. I wrote this down. I want to read it for our listeners as we wrap up here. You wrote, "Unparalleled opportunity to heal and to grow." And that stopped me in my tracks. It really summed up this story, and you can turn that mirror around and look at it yourself and say, you know, boy, what do I need to do in that regards? It's a great read, Mark. Tell folks where they can learn more about you and the books you've written and how to order The Storm on Our Shores.
Well, The Storm on Our Shores would be in bookstores just about anywhere. You can buy it in your local shop or on Amazon or other online retailers. And if you want to learn more about the battle or myself, you could check my website, which is markomasic.com, or probably I've got a difficult last name, so it might be easier to follow links from The Storm on Our Shores. But one of the most gratifying things that's happened to me since the publication of this book was I've been contacted by many, many, many children of veterans from the Battle of Attu. And, you know, that generation, they weren't posting their meals on Instagram every night. There was a lot more privacy and, you know, maybe humility than what we see today. And so I'm being contacted by all these children of vets who say, wow, this is what I knew. My dad was there, but I never really knew what it was like to fight in Willowas and against a force that valued, you know, death over dishonor. And people are coming to me and sharing some of their father's own stories and documents and things that they found. And so that, you know, if any of your listeners know any of that information, the Battle of the Aleutians was in a lot of ways really unparalleled. There just weren't conditions like this. They weren't so ill prepared in other battles as they were at the Battle of Attu. Had to learn big lessons here and move forward. And so if your listeners know more or have family in the Aleutians, please contact me. I'd love to hear you.
Well, we want to thank you, Mark Omasek, for taking some time today to educate our Veteran Radio listeners. It's a great book, and again, I recommend it to everybody, The Storm on Our Shores.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.